I think what I would say is that authoritarianism is ultimately a manifestation of fear, and that a concern for power is in a lot of ways an expression of fear.
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller. The mission of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics is to enhance your physical and emotional well-being and encourage community. I say encourage community because I believe that human beings are basically tribal animals, and we do best when we live in small tribes cooperatively. We are cooperative animals. We collaborate. We love doing all kinds of things together, especially eating together. But we must always be mindful that there's a small percentage of us who are different. They are predators, dominators. They're the ones who came out of the caves with the biggest stick. They eventually became tribal leaders, kings, dictators, and tyrants. These are the people who would have us be subjects instead of being citizens. And we must be aware of these people at all times, or they will rule us. Today, we have with us Kathy Reisenwitz, who has a lot to say on this topic. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, Kathy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kathy, there are a lot of things I want to talk to you about today. I want to talk to you about the finance gap, the orgasm gap, but I want to hear, I do, because in my book, Freeing Sexuality, I talk a lot about the orgasm gap because it was taught to me by some of the researchers that I interviewed for the book. It's a very important thing, and it's right in line with the financial gap, as you well know. But first, you're doing a lot of research and talking lately about the authoritarian personality. Please share some of your research with us.
Well, there's a really great article, and it's linked from one of my posts, most of my posts, honestly, about this, that it's published in the UK, and it talks about, so authoritarianism is usually talked about in terms of being an ideology, and it is, but there's also evidence that it's somewhat of a personality trait. And as we know, personality is somewhat heritable. It's pretty stable throughout a person's lifetime. And so what it essentially means is that there are people who, through really no fault of their own, through a combination of nature and nurture, just have a more authoritarian tendency. Authoritarianism kind of naturally appeals to these people more than it does to other people. And so any kind of free society, any kind of liberal society, is going to have to deal with the portion of the population who has a greater propensity toward authoritarianism. And then also, it would behoove liberals to figure out what activates people's desire for or tendency toward authoritarianism versus what calms those tendencies. And so, yeah, I just think it's a really interesting like line of reasoning where we're not just dealing with like ideas, but we're dealing with thoughts, feelings, inclinations, established patterns. And so we need to approach the problem of authoritarianism from multiple standpoints.
What is authoritarianism? Tell us some of the traits of an authoritarian personality.
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that authoritarianism is conservatism, or that authoritarianism is necessarily right wing. And that's not true. I think one of the big things that's different between authoritarianism and conservatism, for instance, is that authoritarianism is very interested in conformity and uniformity. So they want people to conform to standards and ideas about how to live, to conform to rules, to maintain existing social hierarchies or social hierarchies that they feel are correct. And often these are quote unquote traditional social hierarchies. But whereas conservatism is yelling at history, yelling stop, standing for history, yelling stop, authoritarianism can be very radical. It's not necessarily looking toward the past. It's not necessarily about preserving tradition. It can be very radical and very different from the past. It's much more about enforcing violently uniformity, conformity, lack of diversity. And so those are kind of the main hallmarks. And then where you see authoritarianism kind of put into practices, you know, are you able to tolerate differences? Are you able to tolerate nuance? People with authoritarian personalities tend to be less able to handle cognitive complexity, for example, which is why you see a lot of overlap between an authoritarian personality and someone who believes in conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories tend to be simpler explanations. They tend to tell a story as opposed to reality, which tends to be a lot more complicated and multi-causal. A lot of the things that you see associated with authoritarianism aren't necessarily authoritarianism, but are just manifestations. So, for example, racism. Authoritarianism is necessarily about a lack of diversity. They want things to be the same. That doesn't have to necessarily be on racial grounds, but it often is. Or nationalism, for example. Authoritarians tend to be nationalistic, but some of them are more Christian nationalist versus others are, you know, atheists. But the thing that binds them together is they have a very strong sense of us versus them, versus a liberal who would say, you know, we're all individuals.
Yes, what it sounds like is my concepts of social Darwinism and social humanism, whereas the social Darwinists believe in the survival of the fittest means the most powerful and the richest, and everybody else comes down the line, whereas social humanists believe that we're all in this together and we can make everybody rise with the rising ocean. And it's a very different philosophy. Now, when you were describing the authoritarian, one of the words that you used was violent. And I want you to expand on the connection between violence and authoritarianism, please.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question. I think that there are a few ways that all this, this is hard to talk about because like a lot of things relate to a lot of different things in a lot of ways. And so picking out which connections are like most important is difficult. But I would say a liberal is, I see the most relevant dichotomy or spectrum in politics as not right versus left or conservative versus progressive, but liberal versus authoritarian. So those are kind of the two poles in my thinking. A liberal, says
liberal versus authoritarian. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas like most people exist somewhere on the spectrum. They're closer to authoritarian or they're closer to liberal.
And liberal being more open to new ideas, more open to nuance. Is that what you mean? People who are, people who see us all in this together, like a liberal would be more likely to favor Social Security and Medicare, where an authoritarian might not, because those are close to socialism. Is that correct?
See, and this is why it's complicated, because not necessarily. I mean, a lot of authoritarianism is populist. So one thing that's really interesting that's happened is the right wing is now talking about expanding Medicare. For example, a lot of Republican governors and Republican states are talking about expanding Medicare. You've got J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley, Republicans, talking about, you know, we need more welfare spending. So it's not left versus right. It's more like an authoritarian would say, and this is what's happened, is that now that low-income white people could be beneficiaries of these government systems, then the authoritarians are for these programs versus when, you know, poor Black single mothers were perceived as the beneficiaries of welfare. Well, then welfare was off the table. They're very concerned with identity. An authoritarian is obsessed with status as opposed to wealth. So some games can, like capitalism, ideally, free markets, free exchange, is a game where if everyone plays, everyone is better off for having played. I make something, you make something, we trade, we're both better off. Status is a game where if I win, you have to lose. Authoritarians tend to play status games. They're very concerned with where they are in the social hierarchy. And these tend to be zero sum. And when they say where we are in the social hierarchy, they're very concerned with us versus them. So they're very concerned with whatever they consider their in-group. And so whether and to what extent, like a liberal would say, I want Social Security or I want welfare because studies show that a social safety net benefits all of society. An authoritarian would say, I want Social Security and Medicare because white men like me are suffering and they deserve help. And we should take from the elites to give to the common man, which is the group that I'm a part of. The other thing that really differentiates an authoritarian versus a liberal is an authoritarian justifies using force and violence for what is best for them and their group, whereas the liberal is more interested in cooperative solutions. So like, how do we convince people to do what we want them to do versus violently force them to conform to whatever rules I think are best?
Aren't dictators by definition authoritarian or not?
Yes. I think, as far as I can tell.
Dictators are authoritarian. At the same time, isn't the common definition of authoritarian such that they are looking out for themselves rather than an ideal or the country or the people, that they place themselves number one above all else? Isn't that inherent in the authoritarian personality or not?
What differentiates an authoritarian from a liberal, I don't think, is selfishness. I think both authoritarians and liberals can be equally selfish. What differentiates an authoritarian from a liberal is who is included in the self. I think that an authoritarian is very concerned with in-groups and out-groups, and they consider their in-group human and part of themselves, and being part of that group is very important to them. So whiteness for a white authoritarian may be very important to them, or Christianness, or being an American. But there's something, or being straight, like there's something that's very central to their identity, which they share with certain other people, that's their team, and that's important to them. Whereas a liberal, they share common traits with different people, but they don't think as much in terms of teams, us versus them. You know, does this benefit me and my people or them and their people? A liberal says people are people, and ideally we do things that benefit the most people, versus an authoritarian says people aren't people. My people are people. Those people aren't real people. And my people should dominate and get all the good stuff. And those people should get as little as possible.
Given the way you're describing these authoritarians, particularly in politics, it befuddles me as to why people from minority groups would cast their favor towards an authoritarian, and yet they do.
I think it's authoritarianism. Again, it's not like a white person thing or a black person thing. It's not a conservative thing or a liberal or a progressive thing. It's not that. A good example, I don't know if this is a good example or not, but it's what comes to mind, and maybe it'll get me canceled. But what comes to mind is, in terms of a spectrum, I would put like Martin Luther King on the liberal end of the spectrum and Malcolm X on the authoritarian end of the spectrum, in that Malcolm X was much more concerned with Black well-being, did not care as much about how Black well-being impacted white well-being, versus Martin Luther King was much more about everyone benefits from reductions in racism. So like the separatism of Malcolm X was a more authoritarian kind of idea of Black is the important category. That is the us category. White is the them category. We want to elevate Black people over white people, but we're maintaining a social hierarchy. And we're very concerned with us versus them. Whereas Martin Luther King preached a much more, let's get the whole problem is us versus them. Like we shouldn't be opposed. Like we can all benefit.
But if authoritarian personality castigates an entire race of people, such as saying all Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers.
Right.
I don't follow how Mexican people then vote for that person. If an authoritarian person says things that are deeply insulting to the military, such as making fun of a captured officer, John McCain, for example, who spent 6 years in prison and was beaten and his arms were broken, and then he's described by an authoritarian politician as a loser, why would military people ever vote for such a person? Why do the Mexicans ever vote? How does it happen that these populist authoritarians still manage to get the very people that they cast out to favor them? Do you understand how that happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's important to recognize is that we're all a little bit authoritarian, unfortunately. Like, it's a pretty well-established phenomenon in social science that everyone has a preference for the in-group. Like, how they define their in-group and how strong their preference for the in-group is, that differs. Authoritarians are obviously very high in this trait, but everyone has this trait pretty much to some extent. So that's the first thing to know. I mean, you talk about like people are built or are evolved to live in tribes. Well, a tribe is literally an us versus them. It's an in-group. We are biologically evolved to find and prefer our in-group. But again, the extent to which you can hang in like a liberal society varies from person to person. The second thing is no one can get everything they want. You know, in a world where we have to be part of very large tribes, we're going to disagree on different things. And so as far as like the military, okay, so Trump made fun of a veteran, but he also said, we're not going to get involved in foreign wars. Well, if I'm in the military, you can make fun of me all day long, and it's going to bother me less than putting my life in danger for pointless, you know, violent expeditions.
Good
so
point.
That's one thing. But the other thing with the Hispanics and whiteness is so interesting, which is the category of whiteness changes. It's always changed. It's all the category of whiteness. Whiteness does not just mean a lack of melanin. Whiteness in practice means the dominant racial caste, and who gets to be included as white is up for debate, and it changes over time. There were times when Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants weren't considered white. There's debate now, and it depends on the context, whether you know, count Ashkenazi Jews as white. And so Hispanic people, many people who you or I might classify as Hispanic, consider themselves white. And so when we talk about like, well, you know, why are they aligning with whiteness? Well, you don't get the benefits of whiteness without aligning yourself with whiteness. It makes sense in a lot of ways too. If you're living in a place with a racial hierarchy, if there's any way for you to get to claim the benefits of being a member of the dominant racial caste, like you're going to, it certainly makes sense to try to do that. And a lot of Hispanic people are.
Personally, I find it deeply embarrassing that people who share the same skin color that I have are prejudiced against other people based on nothing more or less than the color of their skin. I find it embarrassing. I find it ridiculous. I find it I find it to be an enigma. But I understand it from a psychological perspective, of course, because I'm a psychologist. But it's you know, it's really one of the worst possible things that humans have developed towards one another. But let's move on to another topic. What's happening with the income gap between males and females? Are we making progress? Are we not making progress? How are we doing in that area? And what do you see coming?
Oh my gosh, what an interesting topic. I mean, what is progress? Is the income gap between men and women narrowing? Yes. is that progress? Sort of. So a few things are happening. One is that men's wages are stagnating, especially in the bottom half of earners. And part of that is that men are getting less education than women, and the economy is moving away from a demand for labor where men have an advantage and toward an economy where women, where demand for labor that women can do, at least as well as men, if not better, there's more demand for that kind of labor. So, for example, one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing, field for labor demand is home healthcare aides, you know, nursing assistants. Some of that does require physical strength and stamina if you like need to lift a patient, but it much more requires patience, empathy, understanding, emotional intelligence. And men are not socialized to do those things. Men are punished for performing femininity a lot more than women are punished for performing masculinity, just in general and in society and in dating. And so even though nursing can be a very physically demanding job, for example, a lot of men don't want to do it because they see it as feminine. Even like the knowledge jobs, right? They require a degree. Men are earning fewer degrees than women. These knowledge jobs require sitting down, concentrating, taking orders. And that's hard for a lot of men who like want to be up and physical and like doing a bunch of different things. So I think it's good, obviously, that we're moving toward an economy where women can be fully engaged. That's great. It's bad in that it's unclear what we're going to do with these men who are not willing or able to get on board with becoming, you know, entering the professions where we actually need labor. And the other thing that's really interesting is women who don't get married and don't have kids have almost no wage gap with their male counterparts. And if trends continue, unmarried childless women will out-earn their male counterparts on average before very long at all, which means since we have as a societal expectation that the man earns more than the woman, this is already causing problems for marriage rates, I believe. You know, women are already, like I said, more educated than men on average. It's likely to only, you know, the degree gap today between men and women is larger than it was in 1970, but reversed. And it's getting larger. So women are already more educated. Once we start earning more money on average, marriage is either going to continue to decrease, like marriage rates, or we're going to have to change our expectations around work and marriage. So progress, like, yes, in some ways, but also challenges ahead.
Well, the reason I ask about that is because from my perspective, men have basically owned women for thousands of years. And the way we've owned the other gender is through money and power. Mm-hmm. And the money gives us the power. And mm-hmm. so the more women accumulate money and earn money, the more power they will have. And that'll until there should be at least equality, if not women taking over. Now, a strong argument can be made for women taking over, because if you look at acts of violence on the planet, men commit acts of violence at a rate somehow, sometimes like 7 or 8 times the number of violent acts as women. Well, that's a very strong argument for putting women in charge, because you would think if the people who commit less violent acts are in charge, then there will be less violent acts across the board in the society. But again, it comes down to how much progress we're making about around this issue of earning money. And you're saying we are making progress, which is very hopeful.
I actually disagree with the idea that it would be better for more women to be in charge. And I say this for two reasons. First, there's way more variation within the sexes than between them. And there are only so many spots at the top of any hierarchy. So what ends up happening is, first of all, right now, women do perform better than men on average in a lot of leadership positions, but that's probably because a woman has to be like 10 times better than any available man to get to that leadership position.
Yes.
And the other thing is, when things are more equal, what ends up happening is like the same kind of woman goes into leadership as the kind, most men don't get into leadership, nor do most women, because most people like either can't or don't want to or both be a leader. The person who wants to be a leader and can be a leader is usually a certain kind of person, and they're not better when they're women. Like a power hungry person who wants to dominate an institution isn't better because they have a vagina, you know, like they're still a power hungry person who wants to dominate an institution. And so when we have more gender equality, I think we're going to see men and women are about equally shitty. And I think that's good because I think whoever is best should be a leader. The other thing that I think is really interesting, and this is like a really tricky thing to talk about, but so the reality is that men and women are on average about equally intelligent, but they cluster differently. So men tend to cluster at the top and the bottom of the intelligence spectrum. So if you look at the very top, like who's the very most intelligent, it's disproportionately men. And also when you look at the bottom of who is the dumbest, it's mostly men, and women cluster in the middle. So on average, it's the same, but where they are. So intelligence is a major factor in who should be at the top of hierarchies, and I think it is, then you might expect to see hierarchies continue to be dominated by men. And that might not be bad, because you do want people who are smart at the top. However, intelligence is obviously not the only factor at play. And so I'm not saying that, oh, well, you know, men are the very smartest people, so they should be the only ones at the top. Like, empathy matters. Being a good person matters, you know, all these things, compassion. There are other traits you'd want in leaders, but intelligence is definitely one of them. And so, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see, like, as we have less sexism, how hierarchies are divided between men and women.
Well, also, Kathy, just because women tend to cluster in the middle and the men at the extremes doesn't in any way imply that there aren't plenty of women at the extremes. It just means when you put it all together, this is how they fall down as a group. So there are still going to be a substantial number of women who are just as smart as men. They're just not necessarily as many women in that category, right?
Totally. And there are a lot of things you want to do with extreme intelligence besides be a leader. And what I've found is what makes a good leader is not necessarily the smartest person. It's often just like conscientiousness, persistence. Generally, who leads the things that I'm a part of are the people who show up. And you don't have to be the smartest person in the world to show up and like be competent and listen to people. So
there's a lot to be said for showing up, isn't there? A great deal.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the orgasm gap. I interviewed some women from my book, Freeing Sexuality, who went into some detail about the orgasm gap. I want to hear what you know about it and what you can share with us.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how little we know about sexuality. I mean, we aren't even like fully sure what a female orgasm is. Like, there is, for example, you know, certain physiological signs associated with an orgasm for a woman, but they're not, you know, universal. There are orgasms that don't hit all the criteria. So it's, I don't know, human sexuality is like so understudied, in my opinion. Like, there's so many open questions, and that's upsetting to me. But yeah, another thing that I think is really interesting is we're seeing the way socioeconomic circumstances are changing, affecting gender behavior. So for example, where women's income goes up, men spend more money on their appearance is one thing that researchers have found. Also, where women's income goes up, women's cheating incidences go up. So what I think that we're probably going to see, though I haven't seen any research on this, as women's incomes continue to rise relative to men's and women have more economic power, we're going to see a decrease in the orgasm gap, right? Women, to the extent that they're having sex, are going to demand more out of their sexual encounters. Another thing that I think is really pertinent to the orgasm gap is that like women tend to orgasm more frequently and more easily in like safer, steadier, more secure romantic relationships. But those are getting rarer. Like people are dating less, they're having sex less, they're getting married less. And so if more of the sex that happens outside of relationships, though I don't know if that's happening, since sex is just decreasing in general. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it's an understudied science. The reason for it is that it's a career killer. There are certain topics that are career killers in academia. I came from academia, as you may remember. I taught at the University of Michigan and Stanford. And the topics that are career killers are human sexuality, hypnosis, used to be chemical dependence, but human sexuality and hypnosis are career killers. And the famous Kinsey, his career was ruined when he went from being a scientist in one area, studying bugs, to a scientist studying human sexuality. He lost his funding. His career was literally ruined. One of the founders of human sexuality, Kraft Ebbing, in the 1800s, was also panned. And so we have a history of certain groups in the United States putting huge pressure on the government, the funding agencies, to ban people who do studies on human sexuality. And that's one of the problems. For example, Grey's Anatomy, which is the number one anatomy book on the planet, in 1985, didn't mention the clitoris. They didn't even mention it at all. There wasn't an anatomical description of the clitoris until, I think, 1989, when an Australian scientist, Helen McConnell, finally did an anatomy of the clitoris and shared it with the world. I mean, this is an amazing thing. 1989, the women have had clitorises for millions of years, but nobody studied it. And we believe things like what Freud said, it's a little penis and so on. As it turns out, by the way, according to the scientists that I've interviewed, the clitoris is a much larger organ than the penis because it goes way down into the vagina. It isn't just a little button that's sticking out on the end. So these are the reasons that sexuality is not being studied. It's a wide open field. You know, I interviewed a professor at MIT, Ole Ogas, who wrote a book with a friend. He's a computational psychologist. He wrote a book called A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And what they did was they analyzed a billion hits on the internet to see what pornography people were looking at. And then they analyzed it and told the world, here's what you're looking at, here's what you're not looking at, and so on. Well, a few years later, I talked to Ole, and you know, he didn't want to discuss the book again. He was concerned because he took so much heat at MIT for even publishing a book on sexuality. And this is MIT, one of the great schools in the United States. So this is what we're still dealing with, Kathy. It's a very suppressive atmosphere for this particular topic. And I think it's related to power. I think it's related to power, to males holding on to power because they really don't want females to come into their own sexuality.
I think the way I would phrase it, just because I want to solve it and you know, the more empathy you can show, I think the easier it is to get people to listen to you. Because, I mean, you and I could talk about how liberalism is better than authoritarianism all day, but if we never you know, it's kind of part of liberalism that we can't just force authoritarians to be liberals. I think what I would say is that authoritarianism is ultimately a manifestation of fear, and that a concern for power is in a lot of ways an expression of fear. I can't imagine a reality in which someone doesn't have someone's boot on someone's neck, and I don't want it to be me. I want to be wearing the boot, not having it on my neck. And so I'm going to do whatever I can do to be on team boot on neck and not be on team getting the boot. And so I think authoritarians are really afraid of difference, and so they are very afraid of female sexuality because they don't understand it, and because they're worried that knowing more about it might in some ways empower women. But because we have to live in a hierarchy, if women are empowered, men are disempowered. And because the people in power are always oppressing those who are not in power, if we learn about women's sexuality, if we acknowledge women's sexuality, if we empower women to have better and more sex and more control over the kind of sex that they have, well, that takes power away from me, because the concern is power. It's not well-being. It's not flourishing. It's power, because that's the reality I live in. I live in a world that I can't handle complexity. I can't handle nuance. I can't imagine a world where everybody gets to be okay. So I have to have power just so I'm safe. And I think I think in a lot of ways, authoritarianism is a trauma response. And I think it's a way of going through the world where someone feels under siege, threatened, unsafe fundamentally. And so they have to control women's sexuality. They have to control information about women's sexuality, just to preserve their own sense of, like, I'm going to be okay.
I think there's another factor, too, which is that at some deep level, men realize that if women are free to use their sexuality any way they want, they're going to take over. It's pure and pure and simple. Because if a woman is allowed to fuck her way to the top, without being put down with such words as, oh, she just fucked her way to the top, rather than, you know, she's really smart, but she also used sex. Well, you know, if men could use sex to get their way to the top, they wouldn't a minute. And when they can, they do. But if a woman does it, they're castigated. And I think there's that basic fear that men have, because it's such a powerful force, sexuality, that we fear it. But let's move on to another topic of interest to you, and not get stuck on that one. Women listening and reading some of the beautiful things that you write, on a very practical level, what can the average woman do to contribute to progress? What can
That's
women
an excellent
do?
Question.
Huh? That's a tough
an
question.
Excellent question. Thank you. Thank you for asking it.
You're welcome.
I'm a very strong believer in it takes all kinds. I think that generally speaking, work at the level that is the most local at which you can be effective. So generally speaking, you're going to get more done working at the local level than at the national level or the international level. It's just a lot easier to have an influence. But that said, if your heart is super in national politics, then, you know, work where your heart is. I think one thing that is very helpful is to be genuinely curious and to be curious about where you see yourself. I think it's easy to look at like something like politics as a team sport. I'm team this and team that, and to be curious about, like, you know, where am I falling into that? I think the most important thing anyone can do to improve their well-being, according to all the research, is to improve the quality and quantity of their relationships. And so if you're looking at, like, what am I doing? If I'm blogging, if I'm volunteering, if I'm posting on Facebook, whatever, is it drawing me closer into community, or is it creating division? And I think that's a really good, like, lodestone of, like, am I on the right path? Is, am I getting closer to the people who I want to be closer to and who make me better and who I can add value to their lives? Or am I distracting myself and creating division? And yeah, I mean, that's where I would start.
When I grew up, after living in the swamps of Florida during World War II, with my dad and mom, my dad was stationed at an Air Force base at a secret proving ground in the swamps of Florida. And after the war, we moved back to New York City and lived in Manhattan. And we lived in an apartment building. And every day when I went to school, I would ride on the elevator. And nobody ever spoke to each other on the elevator, ever. And I didn't know anybody else who lived on the same floor in this apartment building. There were at least 9 or 10 other apartments on every floor. Do you see that kind of situation as improving, or are we still in the same alienation mode as I was in as a child growing up in that atmosphere?
By all of the research I've read, it's getting worse. People are getting more socially isolated. They're getting less trustful of each other. A larger percentage of Americans today than in decades past say, you know, I have close friends. Like I said, Americans are getting married less. They're having less sex. They're going on dates less. I think loneliness is an epidemic, and it's growing, unfortunately. And so that's a lot of why I think whatever you do, it needs to bring you closer to your fellow man and not be part of what's dividing us.
Yes. I'm worried about such things. When I used to go to the theater with my parents when I was growing up, if my mom and dad were sitting, let's say my dad and my mom in the middle and I was on the right side, there'd be somebody I didn't know sitting next to me on my right. The entire performance would go on, and I never spoke to the person on my right, and they never said hello to me. I think this is a custom. People sit next to each other for hours in public places and never shake hands or say hello or anything. I was told by an epidemiologist from Johns Hopkins recently that 30 to 40% of the United States right now is suffering from anxiety and depression. Does that meet the research that you're reading? Does that, those numbers sound familiar?
I don't know, but I could believe it. I mean, I think it's definitely growing. And I think that loneliness is growing, depression and anxiety are growing, and they're very connected to each other and they feed into each other.
We took a big hit with the pandemic, didn't we? We took tribal animals and told them to stay in their own little caves and stay distant from other animals. And that went on for quite a long time.
We did, but I think we really underestimate how long this problem has been brewing. I mean, Richard Putnam published Bowling Alone in like 1996, right? And since then, yeah, by all accounts, we've only gotten more socially isolated. So I think pandemic was certainly a problem. In a sense, though, it was kind of good because it made it hard to deny that being social matters and that we need to be around each other. And it got a national conversation, helped to get a national conversation going about loneliness. I think it made it a little more socially acceptable for people to admit that they're lonely. And so I think that's actually going to be good. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, this is a very widespread, entrenched, and systemic problem. And it's going to take widespread, systemic, concerted changes to help correct it.
I went to the city council in the little city that I live in Mendocino County, in Northern California. It's about 3 hours northwest of San Francisco. And I asked the city council to create a citizens' morale commission whose whole focus would be on how to raise the morale of the citizenry, and in hope that we could create a model commission that might spread around the country so that other little cities and towns might also create morale commissions. It was sort of an idea that came out of a hearing that in Bhutan, they have a czar of happiness. You've heard about that, I'm sure, the happiness czar. And I've heard that when the government makes decisions in Bhutan, one of the things they factor into the decision is what percentage of the people will raise in happiness from this particular decision. It's something that's factored in. And I hope that that would have some impact someday here, but I don't know whether happiness and raising morale, you know, has traction. What city are you living in right now, Kathy?
I'm in Huntsville, Alabama.
What are you doing in Huntsville, Alabama? How do you happen to be there?
I grew up in Huntsville, a little bit outside in Harvest, Alabama. And then I moved to Birmingham and then D.C. and then San Francisco. And when I graduated college, all I really wanted to do was be a nationally syndicated opinion columnist. I wanted to write about politics full time. And instead, I had to do a lot of marketing jobs, which I enjoyed. But finally, I decided, you know what, I'm going to move back to Huntsville because it's much cheaper and I get to be near my family and try to make a go of my dream and write about politics full time and exactly what I want to write about. And so that's what I do. I write my newsletter, Sex in the State, and it's just exactly what I want to write about. And I also organize for local positive change. So I work on legalizing affordable housing in Huntsville and making Huntsville a happier city.
And what is the population of Huntsville?
About 200,000.
Oh, it's a good sized city. It is a very good sized city. And you also write for many national magazines. So you have
I've been known.
You have been known. That's very modest of you. But so you certainly have fulfilled some of that original dream. Tell us about one of the projects that you're doing in Huntsville to help people who are lower down on the socioeconomic bracket.
Yeah, so I've really gotten very interested in housing because housing, I think, is the very highest ROI change any city can make to improve the quality of life for the average person living in that city. And there are so many reasons for this. One is that housing influences in a huge way nearly every aspect of an American's life. The Harvard economists will say zip code is destiny. So the zip code you grow up in a large part determines your trajectory in life. It determines your exposure to pollution, whether you can walk to school, the amount of crime that you encounter. It is important for the environment. It's important for economic growth, how dense cities are, so many things. And housing is most families' biggest expense. And so if you can lower the cost of housing, you can greatly improve quality of life for most American families. And if you can build housing better, you help alleviate loneliness, you help reduce pollution, you help improve public health, you ameliorate racial residential segregation, you close the black-white wealth gap, like so many things with one policy change, which is amending or ideally getting rid of exclusionary zoning. So toward that end, I just launched Huntsville YIMBY, as in yes, in my backyard. And we are a group that advocates for legalizing housing, especially dense affordable housing throughout Huntsville. And we want to eliminate homelessness. We want to, again, close the black-white wealth gap. We want to actually integrate Alabama's public schools because Huntsville's public schools are still racially segregated.
They are
actually under. We are under investigation by the Justice Department for failure to racially integrate our public schools. Yes.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
Yeah.
That is shocking. Well, that
yeah.
that sounds. I'm with you 100% on the housing issue. In fact, I've seen research indicating that your zip code is directly correlated with your lifespan. And right here,
yes.
right here in small Mendocino County, which is a very small county in population, there is a large gap in longevity between certain zip codes and certain other zip codes. And, you know, it's really something. It sounds terrific. I love the work that you're doing. We're trying to deal with the same thing here in Fort Bragg. Housing is a major issue. And with the inflation, it's made it even more difficult for people. And I'm seeing the same data you're seeing, that people, college graduates, are moving back in with their families. You've seen that data. They're staying with their families longer. People are waiting longer to get married. Marriages seem to be on the decline. I see you're shaking your head. Yes, you've seen the same information. And people are waiting longer to have children. And all of this is driven by economics, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's actually data showing that high housing costs depress fertility.
Depress fertility, of course, because people are afraid to get pregnant because they won't know where they're going to live and how they're going to live. One of the positive yes. things that's coming out of it that we're seeing a movement on that I'm involved with is people clumping together in small tribes and sharing housing. And it's all that's also connected to what's called the polyamory movement, where people are living and loving together and raising children together. Actually, I'll share this story with you, Kathy. I interviewed a man who lived in Boston. He was invited by a married couple in California to come and move in with them. He moved in with them. The couple were a married couple, and the woman got pregnant with her husband, and this man who joined them got his name on the birth certificate as a second father. And then 3 weeks before I interviewed him, which is 6 years after the first child, she had another baby, and he's on the birth certificate of the second baby. So both of these babies have two legal fathers and one legal mother. And that's sort of a pioneering kind of event, because the baby, you know, will be living a very different kind of life. And part of what they're doing is philosophy, but part of it is based on economics as well, because they're sharing the economic load. I think people are going to be looking for ways to make it work economically. I don't think people want to live with their parents for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I wonder if conservatives are just like so happy because they've been going on and on and on about how terrible fatherlessness is and how we need fathers. So, I mean, if one is good, two has to be better, right?
Yeah, that's very good. So let's make believe the interview is over. It's not. We have a few more minutes. But we'll make believe it's over. And then we are sitting there alone after the interview. And into your head pops this. You say to yourself, you know, I wish I would have brought this topic up. So I'd like to take a pause and give you a chance. What might you like to use this platform for? What didn't you say, or what might you like to say that we didn't cover? And I don't have any problem with dead airspace, as some people do. So you can take your time. I might even prattle away in order to give you the time. I could tell the people. Go ahead.
I think one thing that I wish I had a better answer for, but then again, I kind of don't, is like, what can you do? One thing that's really frustrating about self-help, and this is why I'm so like focused on policy as opposed to self-help. So I dabble in it sometimes because it's fun. But self-help comes in two flavors, generally speaking. Either it's one of like six pieces of advice that's truly universal, because there are only like six things that like literally everyone needs to hear. everything else is like either only geared toward a certain percentage of the population or has been said a million times. Like those are the only two options for self-help. So there's little I could say that people haven't heard a million times that's truly going to apply to everyone. Like I can tell you what's been helpful for me, but you know, unless you have my same problems, then I don't know that that's what you need to hear. But
I think we do need to hear what's been helpful to you. And if we don't have time today, I'll bring you back another time. I can tell you my number. I can tell you I've been practicing psychology for over 60 years, and I have no problem telling you immediately my number one tool. My number
What's
one
that?
Tool, diaphragmatic breathing. Learning how to breathe is the number one tool because what it does is it reduces anxiety faster than a speeding Valium. It gives homeostasis to the entire system. So that no matter what's going on in my life, no matter what's going on in my life, including being hit head on by a Winnebago and being run over and both my legs crushed, and I'm not exaggerating, diaphragmatic breathing is what I used to save my life because I was able to achieve balance even after I'd been run over. So that's my number one tool. And I say it over and over again, as often as I can. I think it's imperative that everybody learn how to control their breathing. Everybody thinks they know how to breathe because we do, but we don't know how to breathe in tight situations because we tend to tighten up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's great. I mean, I definitely have anxiety and breathing is super important for me. I think for me, I have a lot of social anxiety. And so the two things that have made the biggest difference in my life have been, I think, getting over my fear of strangers by learning some basic tips on how to be socially acceptable to most people. And then, so that's like masking essentially. But then the next thing to battle loneliness has been like, okay, so I've learned how to mask, but then that prevents intimacy because I'm not being my full, authentic, divisive self. And so learning how to be vulnerable, especially with individuals on a one-on-one basis, and reveal who I really am and accept that not everybody's going to like it or be able to handle it at all times, and that's okay. That's been super helpful to me. And it was honestly, it took me a long time to realize I even needed to do those things. I was just like, I don't know, like, I don't know that many people and that's just how it is. And then I was like, oh, wait, that's like a thing I could change. Or like, oh, I know a lot of people, but I'm still lonely. And then I went to therapy and then it occurred to me, oh, that's a thing I could change. So, yeah.
What I taught myself to do in social situations like that is to pick out somebody and walk over to them and say, you know, I get real scared about walking over and saying hello to somebody. Do you think I could strike up a conversation with you?
And I just
put it right out there. And almost always we have a conversation. But if I don't give myself the assignment to go over and do that, I'm liable to walk into the corner and start looking at their books or maybe some of the tchotchkes that they have lying around the house and not talk to anybody. So I give myself that assignment and I say, wait, you didn't come all the way over here to go to this event just to look at the books. Look at somebody and say hello to them. And so then I do that. I say, hey, I get real nervous. Can I say hello to you? And particularly because I'm very large and I get concerned. I'm 6'5" about walking over to somebody and they see this giant animal walking over. Maybe they get a little apprehensive, right? And I pick that up. So then I get apprehensive. So that's the way I got over that.
I love that. I think that's beautiful.
Thanks. Well, it's been great. I think we're coming to the end of our hour. I really appreciate you coming back on the program, Kathy. And as I said before the program, I hope you'll come back from time to time and keep us caught up with the important work you're doing, because I see you as an advocate for social justice. And that's the kind of person I want to hang out with.
I am here, Dr. Miller. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for the questions you're asking and the topics that you're covering. A lot of people are afraid to, and you're doing really great work. And I'll be back anytime you want to have me.
Oh, that's wonderful. And thank you, gentle listeners, for being with us on today's broadcast of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I remind you, we come out with a new program every week. For those you want to hear it fresh, it's 9 o'clock Tuesday morning. The rest of you can hear it on the archives as you do. And remember, I know most of you do remember, open source. We're not charging for the program. This is our contribution to you. Check us out, mindbodyhealthpolitics.org. mindbodyhealthpolitics.org. Until next time, this is Dr. Richard Lewis Miller reminding you that good health is worth fighting for, and it's essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.